It's this afternoon. I'm right.
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday, and it's the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. I got a simple question for you. It's being considered at the Oregon legislature. Yeah, the Washington legislature is up to no good as well. But let's start with Salem. In Salem, they are talking about putting taxpayers on the hook for $800 million. We're talking about 0.8 billion dollars. And is this for something that's critical, like maybe finally getting the public schools to perform for your kids or fixing the roads that even ODOT admits are falling apart right now? No, it's for a baseball stadium. Now, baseball is very popular in America. I don't take a single thing away from that. And I don't dislike baseball, but I really hate the idea that taxpayers would be put on the hook for $800 million. And so far, the way it's being presented to the public, hey, don't worry, we're borrowing $800 million. We're borrowing it in your name, but we promise, cross our heart and hope to die, that you're not going to have to pay the tab. That is, if everything works out over the next 30 years, a third of a century, you won't have to pay the tab. And then I'm going to give you a real example that also involved a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars, at a major university where they built a facility, and they said all of this is going to be paid for with money from sports. And then things went a different direction, and all of a sudden, the money is getting sucked out of a public university. We'll get to all of that. But first, welcome to what we call the best conversation in talk journalism. And you're invited to take part at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, why, we put you right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. If you just arrived, do me a favor. Arrive with a cogent argument, maybe a few facts, a little bit of logic, maybe even some of the law. I mean, whatever works to support your argument and a willingness to stick around for a couple of questions from me. You can also send me emails, talk@LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X, should Donald Trump fire officials who accidentally leaked military plans in a group chat that happened to include, apparently accidentally, a journalist from a major left-wing publications? You can find the poll on X at Lars Larson Show and on our website at LarsLarson.com. It's always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, the NBC TV News affiliate KGW tells the story this way. A key committee in the Oregon Senate held a hearing yesterday on a bill that would clear the way for the state to provide the Portland Diamond Project, which is a private organization, with $800 million in state bonds to build a Major League Baseball park along Portland's south waterfront. The new bill would raise the bonding threshold from where it is right now, $150 million, which is too much to begin with bonds to be repaid over 30 years by what they call a jock tax, the idea that ordinary Oregon taxpayers would not foot the bill of paying off the stadium bonds as long as everything works out just fine. Once the bonds are repaid, funds collected through the tax would go directly into Oregon's general fund. This is some of this tax increment financing that I absolutely hate with a passion. It is based on the idea that if you build it, the ball team will come. And if the ball team comes, if they came on their own to Portland and they bought their own stadium, which is the way I think entertainment enterprises ought to be run, after all, the owners of ball teams make a lot of money. In this case, all that happens is you extend the credit of taxpaying citizens and you say, if we don't pay the bill, they will end up paying the bill, but we promise you we can see off into the future 30 years. Well, let me point out a couple of things to you. You will hear from people that the only way to finance major league sports stadiums is with public financing. And yet the stadium that's no longer called this, I don't know its current name, but the big baseball stadium in San Francisco, once known as Pac Bell Park, was built almost entirely with private funds. So why not do it that way? That's one objection. The second objection is this. If you love baseball, then you should be willing to pay a ticket price that will justify creating the environment. In other words, create the stadium, hire the team, get the teams to come in, arrange all the ball games, and play ball. That's fine with me. But in this case, what they want the taxpayers to do is take a lot of the risk, and the only reward you get is if you happen to be a baseball fan, then you can buy a ticket, probably for a pretty good price, and go and watch a game. Of course, you could do that if the team paid for its own stadium as well. And let me give you this example. 2 years ago, Oregon State University, a public institution, spent a pile of money to build or rebuild a fancy new football stadium, Research Stadium. It cost $162 million. It increased capacity to more than 43,000. Now, how did they pay for it? Well, they paid for a lot of it the old-fashioned way. They went off to alumni and, you know, folks who'd graduated from OSU, and they said, we want to raise some money. They did. But they also got a lot of money from the state. And how were they going to pay it back? Well, they were just about guaranteed to pay it back from all that money from the Pac-12. The problem is the Pac-12 used to generate a lot of money for Oregon State. Now, you can tell if you listen to this show, I don't follow sports all that closely. But what happened? The Pac-12 came apart, and now there's a new arrangement for college ball, and the money coming into OSU isn't nearly as much as was coming in at the time they made the decision. So it'd be like a guy deciding to buy a brand new car based on the raise he's going to get from his boss next month or 6 months from now, and he goes out and he spends the money based on what's going to happen. And then his raise or his promotion doesn't happen. But he still has the obligation to pay off the car, whether he got the raise or not. Now, does it make any sense to put the taxpayers on the hook for such an arrangement? I don't think so. The second thing is the so-called jock tax, in which they're going to tax the teams that come in to play ball in Oregon. Well, guess what? If the ball team, the people who buy the ball team and bring it to Portland, if they have baseball players here and they get paid for working in Oregon, they have to pay taxes to the state of Oregon. Except the state is going to make an arrangement where they say, gee, the taxes we'd be collecting from these ball players that would ordinarily go into the state treasury, we're going to simply take that tax money and use it to pay off the money that was used to build the stadium. Now, that's a nice arrangement if you can get it, but it seems that only major sports teams get that kind of arrangement. I mean, imagine if you said, I plan to, you know, go out and remodel my house. I'm going to add a lot of value to my house. I'm going to spend a lot of money. And then you tell the county, wouldn't it be nice if as I increase the value of my house and my taxes go up, that the extra taxes I would ordinarily pay to you, why don't you let me use the money to pay off the remodel on my house? Do you know anybody who gets a deal like that? Yeah, neither do I, because it doesn't happen. But it does happen when a popular project like this happens. And then you got to wonder, is the ball team going to do well, given the condition that Portland is in right now after the last 5 years with major league office vacancies in downtown and dangerous public transit? And, of course, all the transit folks say, isn't it great? The ballpark is going to be right there on major public transit, like the MAX train. Yeah, is that working out? I don't think so. Back in a moment. It's Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. Oh, for many of us, it's happening. Your hair is thinning out. Your crown's disappearing. Maybe hair loss has you feeling you've lost your identity altogether. Hey, it's Lars. Well, I've got some good news. It's an incredible yet simple one-day treatment that starts regrowing your own natural hair the very next day. And it's guaranteed to grow out for life. It's the Advanced FUE from Advanced Hair. We've all seen the pills and lotions. You know, the ones that come with the monthly subscriptions. They help retain what you have. But what if you want your own natural hair permanently and in specific areas? From Advanced Hair's state-of-the-art facilities to their world-class doctors, it's not maybe your hair will regrow, it's guaranteed your new hair will grow. You decide how much, how thick, and where. Advanced Hair has changed tens of thousands of lives, and they're the team I personally recommend. For your free consultation, $250 off and 250 free hair grafts, call 503-832-HAIR. That's 503-832-HAIR or advancedhair.com.
Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, when are citizens and the mainstream media going to demand that elected officials in the Democrat Party come out and condemn the escalating acts of terrorism around America? Incendiary devices planted at Tesla dealerships in Austin and San Antonio, Texas, were found just yesterday. The arrest and federal terrorism charges against a man in Salem, where he used 8 Molotov cocktails and set a dealership on fire. He came to his crime armed with a suppressed AR-15. Similar incidents in Loveland, Colorado, and even North Carolina. Governors, mayors, and even Democrat Party lawmakers on Capitol Hill are sitting silently as this grows. Reporters from mainstream media join them in silent complicity, much as they did in that deadly summer of 2020. Remember the mostly peaceful line that got used over and over again when Antifa and BLM rampaged in American cities, leaving billions in damage and 36 people dead, including a murder here in Portland and 3 murders in Seattle. Remind you that Kamala Harris spent her time raising bail money to put violent terrorists back on the streets. What do you say, Tina Kotek? And how about you, Governor Bob Ferguson? Don't you like to say that silence is violence? Can American liberals find any better way to endorse terrorism than what they've decided not to do and not to say in the last few weeks? Glad to get your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you'd get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Emery Schrock writes in, Lars, when you call out a failed policy of the last national administration, you typically refer to Joe Biden's fill-in-the-blank policy. Would it be more effective to refer instead to the Democrat Party's fill-in-the-blank? Joe Biden was just a figurehead, and he's gone now. The Democrat Party is still the ruling party in Washington and Oregon. The Democrats should be the ones linked at every opportunity to all of their failed policies, which they are still pushing. Otherwise, your points are right on the money. Well, Emery, thank you very much for that. Now, my favorite post on X today, why is the West, the Western part of the world, hell-bent on destroying itself? Over the last decade, China has increased its electricity production by 70%, while production in Germany has actually gone down by 10%. Germany has taken out all of its nuclear power plants. They're offline, and now it must import the bulk of its energy. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to lawmakers, both Democrats and Republicans, if they vote for this, who want to put Oregon taxpayers in debt and on the hook for 8/10 of $1 billion to finance a private baseball park on which owners are going to earn handsome profits. The public earns nothing at all. Brian writes in with today's best email of the day. You can send more, though, to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mod Pods, a better alternative to tiny homes. They're customized living solutions in your own backyard without the customized cost. Online at GetModPod.com. Well, Brian writes, Lars, I thought it'd be an interesting topic. I and many Oregonians, as we get closer to retirement, we're learning that Oregon has the lowest estate or death tax in the nation. He means the cap. Oregon has an estate tax that applies at $1 million for any estate that is passed on to anyone other than a spouse. Example, a family of three, mom, dad, and child. Dad passes away. All assets transfer to mom. Mom passes away. The estate passes to the child. Under the current law, when the transfer happens, the estate gets a $1 million exemption. Anything over $1 million is taxed starting at 10%. If a family has a $2 million estate, the estate would be taxed $100,000. That tax applies to homes, retirement accounts, bank accounts, life insurance, cars, jewelry, art, etc. It all gets lumped into an estate total and taxed. Many Oregonians are deciding to leave and go to a state with lower taxes and a higher state tax threshold. The federal amount for 2025 is almost $14 million. Oregon is only $1 million and has not been adjusted for inflation in years. Well, Brian, we have talked about that subject, and we're probably going to talk about it some more. But it's a very appropriate question to ask. Why in the world does the state say you spent your whole life building a home, a business, savings, and the rest, and now, even after you die, your estate will get hit one more time by the governor, by the government, saying we've got to get more tax money out of you? Let me go first to Lillian. Hey, Lillian, welcome to Tuesday on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, the stadium. The location is stupid, number one, because not just because of all the problems in downtown Portland. I used to work at the Portland Roundhouse in Portland, and yes, I would run locomotives down a track that goes right past where they're going to do this. There is no place to put this thing and have enough parking where people would not be crossing live railroad tracks. And I can guarantee you there's serious contamination down there,
yep,
from all the industry that's been down there. And if they're going to put it in Portland, Delta Park would be smarter. But I think put it anywhere, it should not be in Portland.
But Lillian, I agree with you wholeheartedly, so don't get me wrong about this. Do you know why they're putting it in a place with no parking? And apparently, I've had a few people say they've looked at the proposed plans for this thing, and they said that doesn't appear to be a parking garage. Lillian, I don't think they intend for there to be a parking garage. I agree with you. Delta Park would be a great location for it. Maybe even a redevelopment of the Expo Center area, but there are lots of places you could put it. But then you'd have people driving to ball games. Do you think that City Hall, Portland, or Multnomah County, or the Oregon Legislature wants people to drive their cars to a baseball game?
I'm sure they don't. But the problem is that that's how people generally go to games.
I agree.
And if they want it to succeed, they need to have parking. And that's probably one of the worst places in the city to put it. I personally would put it somewhere around, I don't know, Wilsonville. So they've got two airports.
And you'd be feeding from Eugene, from Salem, from Staten, the biggest population centers, as well as Portland. But again, I guarantee you, one of the reasons they're doing it that way, they hate cars. Now, can you imagine a family, mom, dad, and a couple of kids say, we're going to go to a ball game, and they live in Hillsboro. So they're going to walk from their house to a bus. The bus is going to take them to the light rail station. They're going to get on a light rail train, and then they're going to take a long trip all the way from there to the stadium. And I can tell you already, the folks behind this and the folks backing it at the legislature are already saying, oh, isn't it great? It's located right next to transit, meaning the train. And then once they get there, and we're talking about tens of thousands of people, at the end of the ball game, can you imagine what is going to happen? Because transit in both Seattle and Portland carries less than 5% of all commuters on a day-to-day basis. If all of a sudden you load up tens of thousands of people, can you imagine that transit is going to take care of getting them home? It's not. And that's part of the plan. And then they want you to pay for it. And they're promising we can look 30 years into the future. Lillian, you're right on track on that comment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
Is it a distinct possibility?
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Should states that allow pornography in public schools still get their federal education dollars? I would say no to that. And in fact, that request has been made in the form of a letter written by Don Powers and Jeff Krupp. Jeff has been a good friend of the show for a long time. Former state representative, Elvis impersonator, farmer, and all around good guy. Jeff, welcome back.
Friend, it's always good to be with you. No, the answer is no. We should prohibit it at the local level. What the Democrats are trying to pass right now, which I call the Dems Porn Forever in Schools bill, makes it virtually impossible to remove pornographic books and images that are in most Oregon schools today already.
Yep.
It makes it virtually impossible to remove them. So what we're asking the president to do is put the money thing out there and just say, hey, you know, if you guys are going to have a state law that makes it impossible to remove pornographic material, sexually explicit material that's completely inappropriate for any age group, well, then guess what? You don't get federal money.
And no, you don't. And that seems like a very simple enforcement mechanism. And by the way, You told me that this letter that you and Don Powers wrote was written to President Trump, but it was literally handed to Education Secretary Linda McMahon yesterday.
That is correct. It was handed to her personally by a friend of the president's yesterday.
Okay, so, and I guess, Jeff, part of what I find frustrating about this, most of the major media doesn't want to cover this at all. There was a young lady who testified at Three Rivers School District, which is not in the Portland Metro, thank goodness, but this mom showed up at a school board meeting, and she started reading directly from one of the books. The book is called The Haters, and it was so explicit that even the words she was saying, you know, when she said them to the school board meeting, and she was very calm and cool and collected, but I couldn't run them on the radio for fear of getting an FCC fine, because it wasn't using swear words necessarily. There were a couple of those,
right,
but an awful lot of it was simply the word picture of ordinary English words, but said in a way that was overtly and explicitly pornographic. And she said, look, this book is already in our kids' school, and I want it removed. And it seemed like a reasonable request. Is there any way of figuring out why it is that school boards are so resistant to the idea? Because I've had people say, well, that's censorship. I said, unless there's a school library that contains 175 million books like the Library of Congress has, there isn't a library in America that stocks every single book in existence, which means at some level, the librarians have to make choices saying, we're going to stock this book on our shelves. We're not going to stock those. Probably it's probably 1,000 to 1, given the total number of books in existence.
Right.
And you'd say, you mean she only puts one book on the shelf for every 1,000 that she might put on the shelf? Yeah, that's probably about the ratio is what I've figured out. So if she's choosing 1 in 1,000, she's already making choices, except the folks in the library profession and the people who belong to their library trade association and their union are notoriously screaming left-wing liberals by their own account. In fact, I think the head of the librarians union has herself said that she's a Marxist and a lesbian. So it kind of tells you where she's coming from.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the standard ought to be that if you can't say it on the air, on the radio airwaves, if Representative Yunker can't read from the floor of the House of Representatives, if the actual pornographic images that are in some of these books cannot be submitted in public hearing in the legislature, then we ought not be allowing it for kids. This is not rocket science, is it, Lars?
No, and it should be up to the local community. I mean, if the folks in Eugene want to have one standard and Portland wants to have a different standard, but Tillamook or Coos Bay or Klamath Falls wants to have a different standard still, shouldn't the local community decide based on local community mores, which differ a little bit, I think, from, say, Klamath Falls or Lakeview all the way to downtown Portland or Lake Oswego?
Yeah, absolutely. They do. But, look, what this bill essentially does, removes local control in large measure over curriculum. And it's not just books, but it's what they're going to choose to teach in curriculum to our kids. And look, if we want to save, I mean, it's all about culture, right? Andrew Breitbart made that connection a long time ago.
Yep.
If we're going to save our constitutional republic, we cannot allow our culture to slide any further down the tubes than where it is today, Lars. And what we're trying to do here today is to make everyone aware that Senate Bill 1098 is going to come to the floor of the Senate soon. And there's a minority report, and that's a whole other discussion we probably don't have time for, that really says the opposite. It really says what you just said, that we ought to allow school districts to adopt their own policies about these things and not take away local control. Folks, be aware. Senate Bill 1098, go look it up on the Oregon legislative website, OLIS, for the 2025 session. Read through this thing, and you're not going to like it, and you shouldn't. It is only to be referred to as the Democrats, because there's not a single Republican on it, the Democrats' porn forever in schools, Bill, and that's what we ought to be talking about. That'll wake people up, Lars.
Hey, Jeff, I'm going to ask my producer, Joel. Joel, can you pull up that soundbite from the Seattle elementary school teacher? I'll give him a moment to do that, but let me tell you what was going on. To your point about the culture in the classroom, I think a lot of us might think, well, okay, so the teacher shows up every day and he or she teaches math and writing and reading and all the rest of that. Except that there is a bizarre set of circumstances going on in too many public schools. So this was posted on Libs of TikTok. It is a transgender elementary school Seattle teacher who's got a pride flag flying in the classroom, and he goes ahead, or they go ahead, I guess is the current nomenclature, and explains why that pride flag is so important to have in an elementary school classroom. Listen.
Anytime I see a pride flag or any kind of sign like she had in her classroom that says everyone is welcome and it uses sign language as well, is to me, that makes me feel safe, honestly. And I know for a lot of other kids in schools, to see a pride flag or to see those welcome signs makes them feel seen and heard and loved and feel welcomed into the classroom.
Now, Jeff, do you think that the average 7-year-old or 8-year-old even has any idea what a pride flag is or what it represents?
No, and they shouldn't be even thinking about that. They ought to be thinking about other things that a normal 7 or 8-year-old would be thinking about, Lars. This is the problem with our educational system. This is why school boards have to have control of these things. They got to have control of their administrations. They cannot let teachers do this kind of thing. That's where the battle is, Lars, for the future of this nation. It's in the culture, and it starts with our kids in public schools.
Well, and by the way, SB 1098, a name renamed by Jeff Krupp as the Dems Porn Forever in Schools bill, the only reason that Salem, and I'll bet Olympia will do the same, the only reason Salem is considering a ban on making conscious choices about which books go in front of the kids and which do not, is because they're afraid that some communities in Oregon will actually say, we don't want those books in front of kids.
Right.
Now, that's not a book ban. Any parent, and there are some freaky parents, not too many of them, but a few of them, who would say, I want my kid reading this explicit pornographic stuff. If you do, there's probably nothing the state can do to stop you. But what can happen is the folks in Salem who say, don't you dare let those communities make their own choices. That needs to be shut down. And as you said, not a single Republican has his or her name on 1098, the Democrat Porn Forever in Schools bill. It needs to be killed. Now, back in a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. And should lawmakers make illegal aliens eligible for food stamps here in the Northwest? We'll get to that next. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show brought to you by 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our poll on X today, you might have heard that National Security Advisor Mike Waltz had apparently added a journalist, a very left-wing journalist from The Atlantic, to a Signal group chat. And if you say, what's Signal? It's an app you can load on your phone. It allows for conversations that are relatively private. Probably not national security private for sure. Well, Waltz accidentally, we're told, added this journalist to the group. He ended up seeing some information about the United States' very justified and righteous attacks on the Houthi terrorists. So that was a leak, and it was a big deal yesterday and probably today as well. Donald Trump says he is still confident in Mike Waltz and in Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary. He also says that Waltz has learned a lesson and is a good man. He also says that he's confident that there was no information on that group chat that constituted a leak of, you know, high security information. So should Donald Trump fire officials who leaked military plans in a group chat that included a journalist? I'd say no to that. Trump has apparently said no as well. And I think that's a good thing. But you can vote any way you like. You'll find the question on X at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go first to Mike in Snoqualmie, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KVI. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, I wanted to comment on Jeffrey Goldberg's claims.
Okay.
I had a top secret special access program security clearance. And what would happen if somebody accidentally leaked something, put classified data on an unclassified system? Cybersecurity would come by, seize all the devices involved, seize all the backup tapes, and wipe out any mention of that classified data.
Wow. That's
pretty thorough. They didn't do that with Jeffrey Goldberg's phone. If they had, we would have heard him screaming bloody murder that cybersecurity seized his phone. He hasn't said that.
No, he hasn't. And by the way, Mike, you know about Goldberg. Do you know why you should know Goldberg's
classified data?
Yeah.
So he's taking a partial truth and spinning it into a falsehood.
Well, look, I think Goldberg shouldn't be trusted with anything, because Goldberg is the same guy who, all by himself, when everybody else contradicted him, was saying that Donald Trump had said that men who had died in battle in World War II were suckers and losers. And nobody who was in the room at the time remembers the president saying anything like that, nor do I think that, based on Donald Trump, what we know about Donald Trump over the last decade since he began running for president, suggests in any way, shape, or form that that's the way he looks at men and women who serve in uniform. So I don't trust Goldberg much.
The administration admits he was on the chain.
He was on it.
But what he's saying about classified data being transmitted is a bunch of hokum.
I would agree with you. I'd absolutely, because what they say was on there was that the attack that was then carried out about 2 hours after that group chat against the Houthi terrorists, they gave some information about the kind of weapons used and the areas that were being attacked, and that was about it. Not necessarily highly classified at all. Let's go to Jerry. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I'm not for violence, Lars, but I drive by the Tesla dealer every weekend to go where I'm going, and there's dozens of people protesting. I wondered what would happen if I kind of slipped into that crowd and seen where they worked. Then when they went to work Monday, I'd protest against them.
Actually, if you didn't assault anybody or anything like that, I think it would be perfectly appropriate. I mean, in other words, you would simply, if turnabout's fair play and you're not suggesting violence or going out and, you know, doxing somebody at their house, you said a man who works at this store was part of the anti, you know, the Tesla protests. But let me ask you a question first. What exactly do you think those people are protesting anyway? Because they all love electric cars. They love alternative, you know, fuel vehicles and all that. I think they're protesting Trump. And they're using Tesla and Musk as an excuse. I think they hate They hate Donald Trump with a passion, and they finally found an icon they can go out and physically attack with things like Molotov cocktails, and as they found yesterday in two cities in Texas, incendiary devices. So they're doing things that are just the same. It's the same MO as what was going on in the summer of 2020, just 5 years ago.
I agree with you. They're against Trump. Whether I'm for Trump or not, they're wrong. They're totally wrong.
Well, look, if you want to go protest, it's one thing. But I just really begs, you know, believability, credulity, that you'd say, so these people who are on the left, who hate Trump, but now they're protesting against an electric car company because the owner of the electric car company has decided that he wants to make the decision to back Donald Trump. Good. I'm glad he's backing Donald Trump. But
I drove into the parking lot, and they steered me down like they were going just rip me out of my truck. And I think sometimes they need to reap what they sow.
Well, and if you did it entirely legally and peacefully, then what's not to like about the idea? It's a Tuesday. It's Lars Larson Show, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Cammie McCormick. President Trump was asked this afternoon about the text chat by his national security team discussing airstrikes in Yemen.
The attack was totally successful. It was, I guess, from what I understand, took place during, and it wasn't classified information. So this was not classified. Now, if it's classified information, it's probably a little bit different. But I always say you have to learn from every experience.
If classified information was not discussed, Democratic lawmakers say the transcript of the chat should be released. Trump wouldn't commit to that.
I don't know. I'd have to ask the military about that because, you know, maybe you wouldn't want that. I don't know.
Defense Secretary Hegseth is traveling to Asia. Senator Mark Warner.
If Secretary Hegseth let this information out, he should resign. There's got to be accountability.
At the Pentagon, CBS News correspondent Charlie Daggett.
You know, just walking the halls, the people I've been speaking to, I would describe the mood as sheer bewilderment. You know, they have a phrase here and other places, but especially here at the Pentagon, when they want to deflect, they say, I don't want to get ahead of. In this case, nobody wants to get ahead of the defense secretary.
More departures from key federal agencies. Correspondent Matt Piper is keeping track.
The CDC just lost five high-level people. It has 24 centers and offices. The heads of five of them are leaving. Some of those leaving, heads of the Office of Science, Office of Policy, and the National Center on Birth Defects. The departures are being described as retirements, but CDC employees have been bracing for the Trump administration to lay people off or reorganize the agency.
CBS News has learned the Trump administration has quietly paused the processing of green card applications filed by some, including approved refugees. It's part of a broader effort to more aggressively vet immigrants. Parts of the West could see record heat today. In the southeast, dozens of wind-driven wildfires continue to burn. Several large fires are burning in the mountains of South Carolina. Madeline Stewart of the state's Forestry Commission.
We're trying to create what's called a fire break, where the fire will not pass beyond that line. So that's essentially what they're doing. It is very, very rough terrain, very steep, as you can imagine.
Consumer confidence fell for the fourth straight month, showing Americans are still feeling anxious over tariffs and inflation. Kelly O'Grady of Money Watch.
It was at the lowest level that we have seen in 12 years, and it came in well below the reading that indicates that a recession is coming. Now, that doesn't always mean every time it's reached below this level, we've had a recession, but in many cases, we have.
And checking Wall Street, the Dow is up just 4 points. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Follow Lars on Blue Sky at Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's a pleasure to be with you. And the question I want to ask you is, what does it change about America's judges and courts if a huge number of our federal judges are now people who did not start life inside the United States, but in fact came from somewhere else. You might say, well, maybe it has nothing to do at all. Maybe it changes their entire perspective. And when those judges are making decisions about immigration questions and say national security or even military issues, does it change their point of view depending on where they came from and how long they've been in the United States? I thought we'd explore that. There's a great piece that I took a look at today, and somebody has finally detailed all of this, and I'll get into the details in a moment. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. If you want to join what we always try to make the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And of course, you can always vote on our X poll. The question you'll find at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find the same question on my website at LarsLarson.com. But here's the reason I think this is so hugely important right now. The Congress, to a large extent, has not been doing its job. I mean, the Congress should do oversight over federal government agencies. And if you want to measure on how bad a job they've been doing at oversight, just look what has happened in the last, 65 days that Donald Trump has been in office. In 65 days, his team, I know, led by Elon Musk, I'm not crazy about a lot of the things Musk does, but when it comes to finding efficiencies in government, and they turn up hundreds of billions of dollars of crazy spending and all kinds of other flaws, like the fact that, I discussed this the other day, one of his team was assigned to go to the IRS. And he went to the IRS, and this is a guy who works in the field of cybersecurity and information technology, IT. And what did he find there? He said, well, the amount of transactions that the IRS does on a daily basis are about the size of a mid-sized bank in the United States of America. And he says in a mid-sized bank, you'd have an IT department of anywhere from 100 to 200 people and a budget of about $20 or $30 million a year. What did he find at the IRS to do the same amount of transactions? Money coming in, money going out. That's what it is. That's what the IRS does. They collect money. They also write checks. What did he find? Instead of 100 to 200 staff members in IT, he found 8,000 staff members in IT. And instead of a budget of $20 to $30 million a year, he found an IT budget of $3.5 billion. Now, look, I've worked for companies before where they overstaffed a particular department. I used to work for a company that was owned by Paul Allen. Didn't know the guy, but he had a gigantic IT department. Even the people in IT said, we've got too many people. So when you have a Congress that's not doing its job, not doing its oversight job, and allowing federal agencies to write so many of the rules and regulations that all of us have to live by every day. Because remember, whether a law is written by the U.S. Congress as a law, or whether the EPA passes a regulation that still has the force of law, it still affects your life. Except that if it's written by the EPA, it's a federal bureaucracy. You don't vote for those people. They don't care whether you like what they've done or not, because they don't answer to the American public. They are in the bureaucracy, and to a large extent, they're almost unfireable, which brings me back to the courts. So Trump goes in and says, we're going to take a lot of these bureaucracies, and we're going to disassemble them. He disassembled USAID, famously. That'll probably save $40 or $50 billion a year. And a lot of the money that was going to highly political organizations and not exactly doing what USAID was supposed to do. EPA, same thing. Department of Education may largely go out of existence altogether. So what does the left do? Do they go to the Congress and say, why, you've got to stop Donald Trump? No, because they don't have majorities in the House or the Senate, and they can't sign a bill. Donald Trump would simply veto that stuff. So what do they do instead? What they have been doing for decades, they go to the federal courts. Well, at that point, do you think that Americans can expect a fair shake from the federal courts? The Federalist points out that the United States District Court for the District of Columbia, this is one of the ones with the greatest influence, the source of many of the cases that are interfering with President Donald Trump's authority, has a total of 15 judges, and one third of them were born outside the United States. And as they point out, while country of origin doesn't come up in most jobs, it is worth asking if judges with ties to foreign nations and cultures are the right ones to make decisions that affect, say, the U.S. military or immigration. The concept of foreign-born judges is a new phenomena in the D.C. district. In addition to 15 main judges, the D.C. district has 10 older senior judges who occasionally hear cases. Some of those date all the way back to Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. All of them were born in the United States. But they point out that beginning in about 2014, about a decade ago, Barack Obama appointed Judge Tanya Sue Chutkan. Now, you heard her name a lot. She was involved on a lot of the cases involving Donald Trump. She was born in Kingston, Jamaica. She came to the United States about 45 years ago, went to a university here. But before Obama put her on the federal bench, she had exactly zero experience as a judge. And yet she is overseeing the legal challenges to the Department of Government Efficiency and its work to slash government spending. Obama also appointed the judge named Amit Mehta to the D.C. court. He also had no previous experience as a judge. He had come here from India. He and his parents came to the U.S. when he was a baby. He was raised in Maryland. He will oversee four of the January 6 civil cases that try to blame President Trump for the injuries and then squeeze money, court time, and political embarrassment out of Trump. The other three foreign-born judges were nominated by former President Joe Biden. One was nominated in 2021, also no experience as a judge, came to Louisville, Kentucky when she was a child. She is the first openly LGBT Latina to be appointed to the court. She presided over an objection to Donald Trump's executive order declaring gender dysphoria as inconsistent with the high standards for troop readiness in the military. Now, do you think she's got a dog in the fight in that case? And you've got Judge Amir Hatem Mahdi Ali, who was born and raised in Canada to Egyptian parents. According to his questionnaire for judicial nominees, he was not required to register for U.S. Selective Service. That is because he was not a citizen until 2019. He graduated from a university in Canada, got a software engineering degree, and went to Harvard Law and got a law degree about 15 years ago. He then worked as a volunteer on Biden's transition team. The question is, when you have people who didn't grow up here, who come from a foreign country, from a foreign culture, and they have become American citizens, you might argue, well, maybe they'll be even better citizens. But maybe when they take a look at cases that have a dramatic effect on the rights and the privileges of American citizens, will they necessarily decide that the way that it should be decided to safeguard the rights and privileges, and especially those God-given constitutional rights that Americans care so much about because they are the thing that makes us such an exceptional nation? Glad to be with you. Always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our poll on X and find that at Lars Larson Show. Coming up, are lawyers actually returning to being lawyers instead of political activists against Donald Trump? We're going to talk about that in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails on the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. The risks and rewards of remote work.
Where are you now?
I'm sitting in my office.
I doubt that.
Why would you doubt that?
If you were in your office right now, we'd be having this conversation face to face.
At least woke progressives won't stop you from listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. First, I want to talk to Richard Porter, who's former national committeeman to the Republican National Committee from Illinois and a 30-year veteran attorney at big law firms. Mr. Porter, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
It sounds like when the big law firms realized that they were sort of on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of policies, that they said, oh, okay, well, we've been basically giving Donald Trump the cold shoulder for a while. But now that he's president and there's money to be made, it sounds like they're willing to put all their politics aside. Does that pretty well sum it up?
I think that there's a general sea change across business and culture generally. And I think that Donald Trump's sweeping victory, really remarkable political comeback, has elite culture back on its heels. And elite law firms swim in that elite culture. So I think that there's a reevaluation generally about where people are positioned. I think that people are looking at policies like DEI and ESG and asking whether or not they were good moves to be making. And, I think what Trump really reflects is a restoration of common sense. I think that we've gone through a period of time, the last 5 years, that was kind of a bizarre period of time. And I think we're coming out of that now.
I guess I'm more willing to give somebody credit for coming to the right decision if they get there because they realize it was the right decision and not because they said, oh, well, you mean we're not going to make much money if we keep going this direction? Okay, we'll change course. That's never as impressive as if at a big law firm had said this DEI stuff of hiring people based on skin color and ethnicity and sexuality, it's not getting us top flight lawyers. Why don't we go back to merit? If they'd realized that on their own, instead of saying we'll chuck DEI when it's no longer profitable, it just sounds kind of sleazy.
I guess I disagree. I started out life as a salesman, and to me, when you were a salesman, you looked at the sales plan, and it told you, what to sell, right? And basically, the company would pay you to sell the things that they wanted to make sure that they were selling. They were strategic and that sort of thing. And I think it's the same thing with any business. I think if you look at the market as being a guide for what consumers want to consume, I think law is just like that. So I don't put I would have preferred that we never took this DEI detour. It didn't make sense to me. But the truth is that's what big corporate America was doing, too. I mean, that's what Wall Street was doing. So, when you step back and think about it, when the Business Roundtable and when BlackRock sign on to some of these ideas, the people who are their service providers, they're going to provide the services that are being demanded. So, look, I think that there's sort of a symbiotic relationship between the law firms and some of, what big, government and some of the activist groups were doing. Big law was in there wholeheartedly. But, they're also following a general cultural trend, which I think Donald Trump is reversing. I think that's all for the good.
I guess the thing that concerns me, Mr. Porter, is that anybody who's willing to turn 180 degrees when there's money to be made this direction, not that direction, back to the point I made, and you said, no, you're just answering the marketplace. Well, maybe, but does that mean that if the next, I don't think it's going to happen, but if the next presidential administration is a pro-DEI, let's say Kamala Harris somehow comes back the third time and wins, or maybe it's Gavin Newsom, who even seems to be changing his tone on a lot of this stuff, that then the law firms will just go back the other direction because that's what the marketplace is demanding. And they're not making decisions based on does this actually make sense, but based on does this actually make money?
Well, look, there are people that are lawyers that are more ideological than other people on both sides. And I think one of the important things that's occurring is the realization that the law firms need to have balance. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that nothing that we're doing today will last if we don't win elections in the future.
True.
It's by winning elections that we're able to secure principles, right? And the other side believes in different things. And if they win elections, their views will be dominant. And that's just a fact. And so I think what this is for those of us who care about these issues and care about whether or not equality is a principle that's espoused by Americans as opposed to equity. Equity is, by its nature, transactional. It's rooted in anger, right? And equality it's a relational concept. It's rooted in love, respect for other people. For those of us that believe in the principles that built this country, we have to win elections because, look, democracy doesn't support itself. It's only supported by people who make things happen and make sure that the right ideas are what are the majority votes, the majority is voting for.
I'm talking to Richard Porter, who's former national committeeman to the RNC from Illinois and a 30-year veteran in big law firms. I guess I wonder, as a non-lawyer, I wonder how they originally sold the DEI to these law firms anyway. Because I can imagine a senior partner, a reasonable person who believes in equality but not equity, and I agree with you on that, saying, so we're supposed to hire this kid. What kind of lawyer is he? Well, he's not very good, but he checks a couple of boxes. He's black, he's gay, and it'll make everybody down in the HR department who's running DEI happy. And you say, so we're supposed to hire this kid, young man or woman, to be a lawyer, not because they're a good lawyer, but because they're the right color or their sexuality is right. Who in the world in a top-flight law firm bought that kind of argument?
Well, I wouldn't say that the kids that are being hired aren't good lawyers. The differences at the very top of that field are, you know, they're very slight. And I think it's one of those things that, you know, it's what it really comes down to is between two people, one person might be slightly better and have some slightly better, you know, grades and that sort of thing. And they might be passed over for someone else. But it's not like the person who's getting hired isn't also good. It's just, were they the best person to be hired for that job? And here's one of the real drawbacks with DEI. Because it calls into question people who are diverse, yep, whether they were hired for their merit or whether they're hired for their other features. And that's really not fair. I mean, it's really an unfortunate thing. And you know, you see it all the time where people, and it's often people on the left, they can hold two things in their mind at the same time. One, we're supposed to be doing this. And then two, sort of looking down on people who are different. And you could see that. I mean, often the left is kind of snobby. It is, you know, that's part of an element of being in the elites, is you think you're special and different. And so, look, I mean, I think the problem with DEI isn't just the people who are passed over, but it's how the success of other people who are diverse are diminished as a result of doing that. Now, think about this. You know, think about, you know, Joe Biden, when he picked Kamala Harris, he was very explicit. It had to be a black woman that he was picking.
Yep. And so which would be, by the way, that would be illegal in the private sector, wouldn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah, it could be. I mean, it could be when you're that explicit about it. And, you know, I think, but by doing that, it diminished her other qualities. And so people looked at her as being a DEI hire, right or wrong. And so what DEI is often about is making the people at the top look better at the expense of the people they're hiring and the people they're not hiring. That's the perverse thing about DEI, is the only people who win are the people who are at the top, because they get to preen and say, look at me, look at how good I am, look at how, you know, how open-minded I am. But the people who are diminished are the people they're hiring, because they've diminished them, saying, well, I hired you because of, you know, the features of your skin or other qualities you might have. So, I mean, that's the crazy thing about this, about equity, is that what it does is it ends up diminishing everybody in the game except the people at the very top. Inequality is completely different, because what that does is it emphasizes everybody as an individual, and we're going to respect people with their different qualities based on who they are. I mean, that's the magic about what America is all about. It was built on an idea, equality, being created equal, which is really kind of an expression of love. Because,
and it makes us exceptional. Mr. Porter, it's a pleasure to have you on. That's Richard Porter, a 30-year veteran attorney at big law firms. And some of the big law firms are signing on for some big deal work with the Trump administration, and they're ditching DEI. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Are you experiencing technical difficulties?
That electrician must be a Democrat.
No technical difficulties here. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, and we love naysayers, you go right to the head of the list. If you want to send an email instead, talk@LarsLarson.com. You can also vote in our poll on X. Today's question, should Donald Trump fire officials who leaked military plans in a group chat that happened to accidentally include a journalist, and in fact, in this case, an especially liberal left-wing journalist named Jeffrey Goldberg, who is most famous for being the only journalist out there who says Donald Trump called men who had died in battle in World War II suckers and losers. Now, the folks who were with the president in the room at the time do not remember him saying any such thing, but Goldberg claims he has proof that that happened. And then somehow he accidentally ends up in a chat group on Signal, which is an app you can run on your smartphone. And he ends up in this chat group that includes the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, and others. And people are asking the question, well, what the heck were they doing using Signal, this little app for smartphones that allows communication in small groups? Well, I've already seen a quote from Mr. Ratcliffe, who is the head of CIA now, who says he was told when he came on board the Signal was perfectly acceptable from a security posture for being able to discuss sensitive matters like this. Well, Donald Trump's already said there was nothing in what was in that group chat that was highly classified. There was nothing that affected American national security. And he says that Mike Walls has learned his lesson and is a good man. And apparently the inclusion of Jeffrey Goldberg was by accident. Trump told NBC News that Goldberg's presence in the chat had no impact at all. And he called the whole ordeal the only glitch. Notice NBC News calls it an ordeal. The only glitch his administration has faced since Inauguration Day. Goldberg says he received a Signal invitation from Walls, who was a member of the group chat. Goldberg said the group also appeared to include the defense secretary, the vice president, and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, among others. Today's poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let me go to Bob, who's a naysayer. Bob, I take it you didn't like my position on not hanging $800 million in debt on top of Oregon taxpayers to pay for almost half of a new baseball stadium. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Good afternoon. I appreciate the chance to kind of set the record straight. So
sure,
first
go
of
ahead.
All,
go for
as
it.
You would say, my dog in the fight. I'm a board member of Sport Oregon, who our whole mission is to bring sports to Oregon, whether it's professional, amateur, whatever. We want to enhance the sport environment in the state of Oregon.
Good.
But I'm calling as a private citizen, not a board member.
Okay.
A private citizen that moved out of Portland 2 years ago for all the obvious reasons, not the least of which was outrageous taxation. But here's my, if you'll let me just quickly tell the story. And then
I'll get to it. Get to it. Instead of telling me how much you need the time, go tell us the story.
Got it. The whole point of this is economic impact. When I listen to your argument, it sounds exactly what we've been hearing from the former mayor and, frankly, the former mayors and city council of the city of Portland. Says, hey, no tax money is going to go to any sporting program in the state of Oregon or the city of Portland. We have mountains. We got rivers. We don't need sports. And we have great
That's
weather.
Not my argument, by the way, that. Bob, so I don't want you to misquote me, but go ahead.
Okay, I did not. Okay, but that's the argument we hear.
No, but it's not my argument. You said this is the argument that you made. It's not my argument. My argument is the Portland Trailblazers pay millions of dollars to their players. Do they pay taxes to the state of Oregon?
Portland Trailblazers? Yes,
yes.
They do.
Okay, now, do those taxes pay for the Moda Center?
Well, at this point, since the Moda Center was sold for a dollar, it doesn't really matter.
Well, by the guy who paid for it. But would the taxes from the income of Portland Trailblazers pay for the stadium? And the answer is no, they don't. So why is it that that people are saying, this isn't really on the taxpayers of Oregon. We're just going to take all the taxes we collect from the baseball players and use it to pay for the baseball stadium instead of going into the treasury of the state of Oregon? That is the taxpayers paying for something, isn't it?
Okay, because you're missing the bigger picture. I just spent 4 days in Seattle at March Madness. I was up there with tens of thousands of people from all over the United States. I bought hotels, meals, an unreasonable bar tab.
And wouldn't all those things have happened if the taxpayers didn't pay for the stadium and the people who are going to make money on the Major League Baseball team paid for their own stadium?
But the fact is the taxpayers did pay for the stadium. You're talking about Climate Pledge Arena. You're talking about Lumen Field. You're talking about T-Mobile. And if we want to compete in the United States with other cities, if we want to be a backwater for the rest of our lives, and you and I can go to our grave.
I want to ask you one quick question in aid of an objection to that. Was Pac Bell Park privately financed? Or what? It's not called that anymore, but when it was built in San Francisco, did they privately finance it?
That I have no idea.
They
don't
did.
Know every
it was privately financed. Why can't we do the same? Say you want a ball team, buy the ball team, pay for your own stadium. Why should the taxpayers pay one dime?
Between you, me, and the rest of the people in the state of Oregon, who's going to pay for that?
Yeah. Well, do it the same way San Francisco did it. They managed to build a whole baseball stadium in the fifth biggest city in America with private
finance. The Lars Larson Show. CB The Hour, sponsored by Progressive Insurance.
I'm Cammie McCormick. President Trump spoke today about his national security team texting details of coming airstrikes. Linda Kenyon has the latest.
They were discussing details ahead of a planned U.S. attack against Houthi rebels in Yemen. But a reporter from The Atlantic was added to the group chat on an encrypted messaging app. President Trump defended his team.
Sometimes somebody can get onto those things.
National Security Advisor Mike Walz deflected questions about how the journalist was on that group chat.
A lot of journalists in this city who have made big names for themselves, making up lies about this president.
The president says none of the information discussed was classified, but declined to answer when pressed to clarify.
Democratic lawmakers reacted angrily. Senator Mark Warner.
If this was the case of a military officer or an intelligence officer, and they had this kind of behavior, they would be fired.
And Senator Jack Reed questioned Director of National Intelligence Tulsi Gabbard about whether the chat was classified at some point.
The question has to be posed to Secretary Hegseth whether he declassified the information and at what point he did declassify it. Do you agree?
Yes, I defer questions to the Secretary of Defense.
Democrats also want the transcript released. An Oscar-winning Palestinian director who was detained by Israel has now been released. Linda Gradstein reports.
Hamdan Balal said Jewish settlers beat him in front of his home as he filmed an attack by the settlers on the village of Susia. He was arrested by Israeli soldiers and released with bruises on his face. He said he was held with two other Palestinians who were detained at an army base, blindfolded for 24 hours and forced to sleep under a freezing air conditioner.
The White House released a statement today on the separate talks with Russia and Ukraine on ending the war. It says the two sides have agreed to avoid military strikes on vessels in the Black Sea. CBS's Charlie Daggett at the Pentagon.
This is progress, and we haven't seen progress in 3 years. So I think this is a glimmer of hope in this, you know, carefully worded statement that we got today.
West Virginia has become the first state in the nation to ban most artificial dyes in food. Correspondent Nancy Chen reports.
Starting August 1st, the new law prohibits any products that have 7 listed artificial food dyes from being served in schools. California signed a similar law that goes into effect in 2027.
Record heat in parts of the West and Southwest. In Phoenix, officials were finalizing their heat response plan.
It's a multi-department approach from emergency services to the public library and everywhere in between.
On Wall Street, the Dow finished the day 4 points higher. This is CBS News.
A riddle brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What do your home and auto have in common? Progressive protects them both. It was an easy riddle. Learn more at progressive.com.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars and now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday and live on the Radio Northwest Network, and glad to get your calls. I got this question for you. Should employees who choose not to go to work, they go on strike, and then they get a free check in the form of an unemployment payment? My answer to that would be no. It always has been no. And I thought I'd invite on Washington State Senator John Braun, who's the new head of the GOP caucus. Senator Braun, welcome back.
All right, thanks for having me on.
Are they going to be able to actually get this through? Because you know it's being pushed in both Oregon and Washington to qualify people who voluntarily walked off the job, who have a job to return to when they choose to return to the job, that they're going to be qualified for unemployment. And I just think it's dead wrong, although it looks like a smoking good gift from the Democrats to their friends in the unions.
Yeah, this bill is deeply unfair. It was proposed last year here in Washington. We were able to stop it. This year is a little tougher, frankly. But yeah, it's definitely putting, you know, the government's hand on the scales when it comes to discussions between employers and employees, and certainly employees have the right to organize and strike. But the idea that they don't have sufficient power to negotiate for, you know, good labor agreements with employers is just dead wrong. And we've seen that play out a number of cases around our country just in the last 2 years, where employees have gotten very good agreements with employers under the current situation. Now this will allow them to go on strike, be paid by the unemployment fund, which is funded by all the workers. And remember, in Washington, at least only about 15% of folks are unionized. That means the other 85% are going to subsidize these folks going on strike of their own choosing and negotiating for better wages. And again, I don't have any problem with negotiating, but why should they be subsidized to do that?
And by the way, I know somebody, Senator, is going to call in and say, well, John Braun is wrong because he said the workers are paying for it and it's actually a tax paid by the employer. But I pay it on behalf of my workers, and I pay it, you know, in other words, if I had no workers at all, I don't have to pay unemployment. But if I do have workers, then I have to pay it. So I pay it as a consequence of employing people. And so anything I pay to the state for unemployment is money I can't pay to my producers, who do a darn good job, by the way. But they're going to say, well, no, that's not really the workers paying that. That's their boss. I beg to differ. In the same way that Social Security taxes are collected half from the worker, half from the employer, but all for the benefit of the worker, that's something that's effectively being paid to the worker. Would you agree?
I agree entirely. And if somebody wants to quibble on technicalities, the reality, it all comes out of the same pot, and that's money that could be paid to workers if it's not sucked up in unemployment insurance fees that will subsidize other workers striking. I mean, yeah, you can get bogged down in the individual details, but the fact is this money comes from the same pot, and you can't pay it to your employees if you're having to pay it to the Employment Security Department here in the state of Washington so they can subsidize other activities.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Senator Braun, is this thing basically at this point, it's on a glide path to Bob Ferguson's desk?
Well, I am worried that's the case. I mean, we didn't have much success at stopping it in the Senate. We were able to stop it last year. And this year, it's even worse. We did get it reduced from 26 weeks of a benefits to 12 weeks, but 26, 12, either way, it likely puts the business in receivership before they ever get back to work. I mean, that's a long time to be out on strike. We saw the Boeing strike here last fall in Washington, went on for, I think, 6 weeks. By independent estimates, it cost our economy $10 billion. So it's not just a cost to the Employment Security Department, to the UI Trust Fund. It's also all the associated costs that go with extending the strike beyond what would be required to reach an agreement. It's going to be devastating to our economy and to the cost of doing business here in the state of Washington. People who are supporting this and at the same time say they want to, you know, improve services, improve infrastructure in state, I just don't take them serious. If they're serious, they wouldn't be doing things that's going to drive up the cost of doing things here in the state of Washington.
Well, is it fair to say then, and because I don't want to overstretch this point, but is it fair to say that if this becomes law, and I don't know if Ferguson's even been asked about it, but I would assume he's going to sign the thing, that we're going to get more frequent strikes and we're going to get longer strikes almost by definition?
Yeah, it certainly seems logical. Common sense would tell you if you're going to subsidize strikes, you're going to get more of them. I don't know how you draw any other conclusion. Now, I don't know. I have talked to the governor about this. He hasn't said one way or the other. You probably already know this, but Governor Newsom down in California vetoed this idea here a couple years ago, and he said he was doing that because of the high, you know, big deficit in their budget, and it just was the wrong time. But if you look at their deficit and the deficit here in Washington right now, Governor Newsom, by the same logic, would have even more reason to veto it. He certainly hasn't told me he would do that, but I hope he understands the devastation this will have on our economy.
Yeah, and there's at this point, there's no fix other than perhaps maybe getting Ferguson to do the same thing that Newsom had done.
That's what I think. I just can't. I'm hopeful, and we'll keep trying. I know the House Republicans are working to stop the bill. This House Democrats passed this bill out of their chamber last year. So it's going to be a tough go to try and stop it there this time.
Senator Braun, thanks very, very much.
All right. Thanks for having me on. Have a great day.
Appreciate you having on this show. That's Senator John Braun. Let me go to naysayer Theodore. Hey, Theodore, what do we disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Well, I called up about the law guy. You know, I've worked in that industry for on and off for 30 years myself, not in the big firms, but guys that work for them. But the DEI, what the DEI really is about is it's lowering the cost of labor. It's not about diversity. It's about dollars and cents, lowering the cost of labor, keeping the newer attorneys in the firm down there in document review, and the guys at the top, the partners, they're making more money. That's what the whole population replacement thing is about. DEI is just hand in hand with population replacement.
Hold on, Theodore, that might be the one place we disagree. How does it lower the cost of labor if you hire less competent people but hire them based on their physical characteristics?
Because they are going to stay at the firm even if they don't move up. And plus, it increases the supply of attorneys because people that maybe did not get admitted to law, they got admitted to law school because they were black or whatever, Hispanic, they got into law school, they increased the supply of attorneys. But again, it's all about delivering, and I do agree with that guy to a certain extent, it's about delivering money to the top of the people at the law firm. He said it makes them look better.
It makes their paychecks bigger, too, and I'm sure they're all happy about that. Theodore, thanks very much. You know, he's been calling the show for decades. That's the most sensible I've ever heard him. Back in a moment, why are some governments trying to institute euthanasia? Are they trying to kill us all off? We'll get to that next.
Everyone's favorite color is gold.
I can proudly proclaim that the golden age of America is upon us.
Sit back and enjoy. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And you want to ask yourself, or you should be asking yourself, I think, why are some governments on planet Earth, and not just the government of the United States, but the governments of individual states, of the 50 states, 58 if you happen to be an Obama fan, why are they trying to kill you? And I will tell you my theory as to why they have a dog in the fight to try to exterminate certain classes of people, and I'll give that to you in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We've had some good naysayers today. So if you're a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and of course, you can always vote in our poll on X. The poll on X can be found at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. Should Donald Trump fire the officials who accidentally leaked military plans in a group chat, happened to be on Signal, that included a journalist? Now, I'll tell you what, I got a great conspiracy theory from one of my producers, Joel, who said, how do we know this wasn't just an elaborate setup to deliberately drop this stuff in the lap, ironically enough, of one of the most left-wing journalists in America, a guy named Jeffrey Goldberg? How do we know that they didn't do it on purpose? Well, Trump has already said he's standing behind Mike Waltz, who's the national security advisor. He's also standing behind the defense secretary, Pete Hegseth, the vice president, J.D. Vance. I was not being mentioned by the folks who are demanding the resignations, but the left is going absolutely nuts about this. But Trump has already told NBC News that he thinks Waltz has learned a lesson and that he's a good man. It sounds like he's simply going to move on past this one and ignore all the peanut gallery in the mainstream press. But glad to have you vote in the X poll. Find it at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Now, I've talked about euthanasia and doctor-assisted suicide a lot over the last 30 years. And why? Because I think it's especially dangerous when governments begin to decide that they have an advantage to be gained if they can talk some citizens into ending their own lives early. Now, they call it doctor-assisted suicide. It's always sold in very, very positive terms. Well, if somebody is suffering and they know that their life is soon going to end, then shouldn't we let them simply take their own lives? Now, doctors are involved in this, but even the doctors, you can tell, are queasy about doctor-assisted suicide because they will write you a prescription, but it's up to you to get the pills. It's up to you to take the pills. They're not going to do it for you. Even though if you really wanted to put down a human being, I'm using the terminology that you'd use in a veterinary clinic, say when your dog or your cat becomes so old and is in such great pain, you take your pet down, even though you love your pet, you take your pet down to the vet and they give the pet a shot. It's the same kind of drug that's used in injection executions in American prisons where that's still done. So it's very, very pain-free. There's the prick of a needle, and then the drugs go into your system, and then you simply stop breathing and you die. Now, should we do that with human beings? My answer to that is always no. But then again, I'm pro-life. I'm not pro-abortion, and this stuff is crazy. But one of the best writers on this subject is a guy by the name of Wesley Smith, who's at the Discovery Center, which is located in Seattle. And he put together a list today of absolutely extraordinary cases, not just from America, but from all over the world. He says, for example, a Spanish father lost his legal case to prevent his daughter's euthanasia. The young woman, his daughter, has a severe mental illness, tried to commit suicide, that left her a paraplegic. Well, a court has now decided that because of her disability, the doctors can finish what she started. And as Wesley puts it, that's awful. Euthanasia killings in the Netherlands increased by 10% in a single year between 2023 and 2024, with almost 10,000 people in the Netherlands killed by doctors in a single year. Lethal jabs for the mentally ill have also gone up from more than 200 to more than 400 patients, and there were at least 54 reported cases of simultaneous euthanasia deaths of family members, and they don't say how many of those people were organ harvested, although Netherlands is a bit notorious when it comes to organ harvesting. You're basically in that country, the law says you are opting into organ donation unless you deliberately and very precisely say why you want to opt out. Nearly 4,000 people in Belgium were euthanized in 2024, and they said the vast majority of patients had physical and psychological suffering. Only 16% experienced physical pain, and about 1.9% had psychological suffering. Belgium has also become a euthanasia tourism destination. At least 120 people have traveled to the country from other countries so that they can be killed. In the UK and Great Britain, hospices and palliative care facilities are having their budgets cut, which is forcing them to provide fewer and smaller services. And then people who are looking at the end coming at them with fewer options to relieve their pain and their suffering, they're opting for suicide. And of course, in Great Britain, the government has a most decided dog in the fight because they pay for health care for the vast majority of people in the UK. They have what's called the National Health Service, and it's notorious because of the wait times and everything else, kind of like Canada. The Delaware House of Representatives has passed an assisted suicide bill. The outcome in the Senate is going to be close. Last year, a Democrat governor vetoed a suicide bill, but now there's a brand new governor. In New Hampshire, they voted to table an assisted suicide legalization bill, and I think that's good news as well. That doesn't kill the bill, but it is ailing and hopefully will not proceed further. And according to an article in the British Medical Journal, this is from Wes Smith, doctors cannot accurately determine who is going to die in 6 months. So when you have somebody who says, hey, I want to get doctor-assisted suicide, but you have to predict, is the person likely to be dead in 6 months? Even the medical experts say there's no way for a doctor to tell. Let's go to Curtis. Hey, Curtis, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
I heard you talk about the death penalty, and I've worked in three prisons down in Florida and talked to a lot of inmates and stuff like that. I was working as a kitchen supervisor down there.
Yeah.
And I'd like to know what your thoughts are on having a death penalty be an option for the prisoner, saying, hey, I can't do the time. I want to get out of here, and better luck next time.
No, I don't want the state to be involved in killing somebody because they say they're suffering. I do want to see the death penalty used to execute the worst of the worst, people who have committed the most heinous crimes. And the death penalty is, there are more than 10,000 murders a year in the United States, and the death penalty is assigned by juries maybe 400 times out of that. So we reserve the punishment as a punishment for the people who are the worst of the worst. But I don't want to see it as an option, saying if you're depressed because you're sitting in prison serving your sentence, it should be depressing that you have committed a crime so bad that society says you have to be locked up for a number of years. And if you then say, well, I'd rather just check out and I want the state's help doing that. No, Curtis, I wouldn't endorse that at all. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Now. Lars' daily question to all the Dems in our government.
What would you do with a brain if you had one?
Now, the one with the brain, Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And as usual, you know, things are going slowly in Washington, D.C. I kind of wonder if the folks who worked in the House and the Senate and they did their jobs in the private sector at the same speed and with the same efficiency as they do on Capitol Hill, would any of them actually have jobs today? And I would apply that to both Democrats and Republicans. But now House Republicans are calling on the Senate to take up the House passed budget and get it going so that they can get on with the rest of President Trump's legislative agenda. Elaine Parker joins me now, who's president of the Job Creators Network Foundation. Elaine, welcome back.
Hey, Lars. Thanks so much for having me.
So are they going to get busy and actually get this thing passed? And will it actually start producing many of the things that Donald Trump has promised to do as president?
Well, I mean, it's one big, beautiful bill. I mean, what else would it do other than produce everything Trump has said it's going to do? Look, I mean, the Senate Republicans need to get on board. They need to pass this one big, beautiful bill. This is a win on the board for the Trump administration, for Republicans. And I just hate to see Senate Republicans kind of snatch defeat from the jaws of victory on this one, because we need to extend and expand the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It really does cut spending while giving Main Street the tax cuts that they need and deserve for small businesses and everyday ordinary Americans. And the reality is if these tax cuts are allowed to expire, Americans and small business owners are going to face a 22% tax increase. And that'll be, you know, because Congress didn't get this done.
Do you understand, though, that, I mean, Elaine, you're in the job creator business, so you probably understand this. I think that sometimes Senate, both Democrat senators and Republicans look at the job the way the worst kind of employee does. I get paid the same whether I move fast or not. You know, I mean, we've all run into somebody who takes their job and says, you know what, I get paid the same whether I go fast, whether I go slow, so I'm going to go slow. And they still get to keep the cool office and the nice title and the accolades from the public. And they don't seem to feel a sense of urgency. And yet I'm trying to imagine somebody out there who runs a small business with, say, a few dozen employees. And they're thinking, you know, this is the year. I'm feeling optimistic. That's what all the surveys show. I might want to add some more space to my business. I might want to build onto my business or rent that space next door. I might want to buy some new equipment. I might want to hire some more employees, except they can't do any of that if they don't know what their tax bill is going to be after December 31st.
Lars, you hit on such an important point, and that brings us back to the word certainty. We cannot let this entire year go by, and on the eve of, you know, New Year's Eve, 12:31 at 11:59 p.m., we cannot let that happen where they finally come in and pass it like they do with so many things, because small businesses, they need certainty more than anything else. Even if we have, you know, more than having great tax policy and great regulations and all those things, they need certainty because they need to know how to plan. If it's going to be bad tax policy, they have to plan accordingly. If it's going to be good tax policy, they get to plan accordingly. But either way, certainty is like the top of the list for small businesses.
And yet, does the Senate, or do you think the individual members of the Senate understand that? Because I think they get very focused on their own agenda, saying, well, if we get this bill passed, whether we get it passed in March or whether we get it passed in October or November, it's the same. We pass the bill. We can go home and say, I voted for the great budget, the big, beautiful budget. And I don't think they take into account what this does to individual businesses, which means what it does to individual employees.
Absolutely. And that's very problematic. You know, thankfully, Speaker Johnson has set a pretty ambitious goal of finalizing a budget blueprint with the Senate and getting it passed in the House by the week of the 7th. And the Treasury Secretary Bessent and Kevin Hassett are going to huddle with the GOP leaders and the tax writers and hopefully come up with a plan to get this passed. Because certainty is the name of the game, and we have to get rid of this quiet standoff between the two chambers that seems to have occurred.
I'm kind of curious what you think. I saw an economist yesterday talking about this, and I can't remember his name, but he seemed pretty smart on the issues. But he said, look, Trump's plan is going to work because we have a government that takes in about $4 trillion, spends about $6 trillion, so we accrue $2 trillion in debt every year. I mean, anybody could understand that. That's kindergarten math. But then you say, well, so what's he going to do? Well, find $1 trillion in cuts. You know, I think Donald Trump could find $1 trillion in cuts and then say maybe find a way to increase revenues by about $1 trillion. And that could happen as well. And then you end up with a balanced budget. And if you keep on making the government more efficient, cutting out the waste, fraud, and abuse, you could actually get America from accruing $2 trillion more in debt every single year, which sounds like it's suicidal economically, and get us to something where we can actually start fixing the problem. Do you think I'm being overly optimistic and assuming that we might be able to make that big a change to our own government at the federal level?
You know, I don't, Lars, because during Trump's first administration, we saw exactly that happen. He got the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act passed. We saw the economy roar. We had the greatest economy we've had in half a century, lowest unemployment, low interest rates, low mortgage rates, low grocery, low energy. We were in energy independent. I mean, all of those things happened under the first Trump administration. Those are the policies that he's trying to get back in place. He's declared a state of national emergency on our energy production to get us back producing energy, because that's the root of all the evil, right? I mean, that is what has caused a lot of this inflation. He's looking at how to cut spending. He's got Doge in there with Elon Musk. He's starting to talk about, bring down the interest rates and seeing if the Fed will start to consider that. I know they kept them steady last week, but, you know, hoping that, you know, coming up on the next meeting, maybe they'll look at reducing rates. Maybe not, but, you know, that'll come later if that's the case. But all the other things are in place. We're starting to see gas come down. We're starting to see groceries come down. Energy production is up. I mean, all of those things are happening. It is happening at breakneck speed for Washington speed. Maybe not for private sector, but I would say their heads are spinning in Washington, D.C.
It sounds like glacial speed, though, to the rest of us. I kind of wish, I mean, everybody else, and I'm guessing that almost everybody listening to this, if you have a job, you have deadlines. And yet the Senate and the House never seem to have deadlines unless, as you point out, somebody like Speaker Johnson says, we're going to get this done. But over at the Senate, you know, the big club, they don't seem anxious to actually get busy with the job.
They really need to get on board with this one big, beautiful bill. I mean, I love saying it. One big, beautiful bill. I mean, two bills would be ridiculous. Let's get on board with it. Let's get it passed. Let's bring some certainty to Americans and our small businesses so that they can plan.
And by the way, I would love to see if they make the kind of big, beautiful economy with the job opportunities, then they can go after some of the social side of this and say, oh, you want food stamps? You need to be out working a job if you're 18 to 55 and able-bodied and sound of mind. And you say, well, what do you mean I have to work if I want food stamps? Yep, that's what the federal laws say. A lot of states get exceptions to them. I'd like to see all those exceptions done away with and say, if you want us to buy your groceries, you have to show that you're willing to contribute, even in a small way. Get people back working again, and then that will not only cut the cost of the social programs, but it'll increase the amount of tax revenue and problem solved. Elaine Parker, thank you very much. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Busy, which is why KXL is everywhere you go. Stay connected with FM News 101 on the radio at KXL.com or on your smart speaker. FM News 101, we've got you covered.
Does Lars finally agree with Chuck Schumer?
Of course there's some wasteful spending, but you don't use a meat axe and cut everything.
Pass out the chainsaws and welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And I got my
chainsaw. Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network. And let me give you some good news, because it comes almost every single day out of the White House. There is a new executive order, and I know you're saying, but he's probably signed about three gazillion of these things. Well, consider this one. It's one we've all wished would actually happen. Donald Trump has signed a sweeping executive action to overhaul U.S. elections, including the citizenship requirement. Now, of course, this only applies to federal elections, so that would be elections for President of the United States, Vice President, Senate, and House. But if he's doing this, this is going to push an awful lot of states, because if they say, well, we have our own local elections, we're going to run those so that we can include children, we can include illegal aliens, we can include all kinds of people. But when it comes to the presidential election and the elections for the House and the Senate on off election years, the midterm elections, they're going to have to comply with new executive actions to overhaul the elections, including a citizenship requirement. I'll get details on that as soon as we've got them available. In the meantime, glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network, and always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Danny, welcome to the program. Thanks for listening.
You betcha. Thank you, Lars. I appreciate you having me on the show.
You bet.
I just wanted to say a few things here. So as a small business owner myself, our local area has had four burglaries, at least three of them have been within the last month. My problem is, so we live in a rural area where there's not an active police force. By the time that the law enforcement is able to respond, which thank God that they even have the ability to respond, unfortunately, it's already past the case. So, you know, the buck's already been walked through, so to speak. Well, my problem is there seems to be no accountability within the community of, hey, who's going to help keep watch on some of these things? Now, as small business owners, I'd like to be able to band together and get a group of us together that says, you know what, enough is enough. We can't afford to keep losing profit. We can't afford to keep watching things happen. And we're not just going to stand by and wait for our law enforcement, who is probably already overworked and understaffed, to be able to step in. So I just wanted to pick your brain and see, other than maybe like a neighborhood watch program, what would you suggest?
You know what I'd suggest? Two levels. Number one, a neighborhood watch. And I think that's a good idea. It's a totally worthy idea. But number two, you've got to get law enforcement to be managed differently by the city and the county. Since you're in a rural area, I'd say it's the county, which means you have to go to your county board of commissioners and say, what are you going to do to address these crime problems? And is the local sheriff's department, because if you're in a little incorporated town, even in a rural area, if your town contracts for police services from a nearby town, another town nearby, or if you simply have a service from the sheriff's department, then you've got to say, and how are you running that? And are your deputies being aggressive about going after crime? Now, they can't do anything about the DA. The DA, again, is something you'll have to address countywide. But there's a reason the DAs are elected, because when a DA doesn't do his or her job and says, I'm not going to prosecute those cases. Those are little cases. Danny, have you ever heard a thing called the broken windows theory?
I have. Would you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, it was invented by a liberal, James Q. Wilson, decades ago. And his basic idea was, if you go out and you take care of the small stuff, a lot of times the big stuff will take care of itself. Now, not everything, but it was applied. I think the best example of it was Rudy Giuliani, when he was mayor of New York, applied it to the whole city and to Times Square in particular. And they said, we're no longer going to tolerate the little stuff. And when they did that and they started doing enforcement, even at that low level, they changed the point of view of the people in Times Square. They started to lock people up, or at least take some action against them. You know, if somebody's committing, say, graffiti, and you say, we're going to arrest you and we're going to ticket you for that, and there are going to be consequences, all of a sudden, a lot of the other crimes took care of themselves. So that's a way to address it, but you've got to get, and if the county commission said, no, we like the way the sheriff is running things, and we like the way, and I think that even county commissions could put the squeeze on the DA. And the way they would do that is to say, why is it that when we actually catch these people who are doing the crimes, that you're not doing much with them, and put the DA's feet to the fire? And you can use the bully pulpit to an incredible degree. I mean, I've suggested it recently that when you see federal judges who suddenly, you know, say, oh, I'm a federal judge out in, you know, some corner of America, but I can veto anything the president of the United States does. You know who could shut that down? John Roberts, the Chief Justice. Now, can he actually sanction those judges? He can't. But if he came out and said, I don't want to see individual federal judges do this, that would have a powerful effect. I don't think he wants to do it, so he's not going to. But if you went to your county commission and said, are you going to put some pressure on the DA to start prosecuting people for the crimes that are wrecking our community? And if the county commission says, no, we're not going to do it, say, good, we'll be happy. And I would use video. I would come to county meetings, and I would challenge them with questions and get somebody else to roll video on it. And then post it. Say, here's your county commission that have said, we don't think you have a crime problem. It's all your imagination. Or there's nothing we can do about it to put pressure on the DA to actually prosecute. Or there's nothing we can do to the elected sheriff to get them to have their deputies do business differently. Say, fine, we're going to publicize that, and you'll pay for it at the polls next time. Danny, thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson.